enough for it. Hi, my name is Cece. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 1st of 2012. Since that date, I have not had a drink, pill, potion, or lotion that has affected me from the neck up. I have a sponsor. You actually heard her like a month ago. Her name's Joyce, and she's taken me through the 12 steps a number of times, has shown me how to try to live life like a sober woman of AA, and she's also helped me learn to sponsor women personally, which is about the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me. But we'll get to that. And I do have a home group. It's the Hughesville Thursday Night Group in Hughesville, Maryland. We meet at 8:30. I'm doing the raffle right now. If you want to come holler before I rotate out of that position, that's where I'll be every Thursday night. And the prescription that I've received for my home group is if I'm, dead sick or out of town, then I can miss it. And if I'm not dead sick or out of town, there better be a darn good reason why I'm not there. And I always have heard people say those are the three most important things you'll ever hear out of me. And I didn't really used to get that, but today I do. Because since the day that I finally was able to put down the drink and enter into Alcoholics Anonymous, once those things were established in my life, I have not had to let them go. And regardless of whatever else has been going on in my sobriety, rain or shine, good times, bad times, acting well, not acting well, whatever, those things have been consistent here in AA. So if you don't hear anything else, those are probably the most important three things. And perhaps if there was a fourth, it's that Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's ever happened to me, bar none. And if I talk about anything good in my life today, and I forget to mention it then, it is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what's been done for me and to me here. I was a weird kid. Many of us are weird kids. Some of us are normal. Kind of a weird, kind of crazy family. Nothing too nutty. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. Just a lot of stuff going on there. And I was just strange. I didn't feel like everybody else. In elementary school, during recess, all the other kids would play, and I would climb up to the top of the playground and, like, press on my eyes and hold my breath to try to make myself, like, hallucinate while everyone else was, like, playing kickball. And I didn't see that there was anything weird about that. And I was the only kid, I was the only kid out of all those kids, and probably not the only alcoholic out of all of them. But ever since jump, ever since I can remember, I was always trying to do something to get out of myself, to make myself feel different. And in those early years, to me, it was just intuitively the way I knew how to act. I knew to lie from the first, sort of tall tale that I can remember telling. It felt very natural, sometimes to get out of trouble, sometimes just to, just to lie. I knew how to do things around the house that I wasn't allowed to do. Again, sometimes to get something I wanted, and sometimes just because I was, like, wired to misbehave and to do my own thing all the time. I was never really part of a group of friends. I jumped around like groups of people and was always kind of, trying to find out where I fit in. And I never felt like I did. I mean, I thought that it was because I had a crazy family. I didn't know. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or I became one. I think that that's completely irrelevant to where I stand today. I know some people spend a great deal of time talking about that. But when I got into, for me, it was, around middle school age. And I got a wind of the fact that the kids around me were doing, doing drugs and drinking. I was opposed to it. I thought that that was terrible. I was never going to drink or do drugs because that, that was stupid. And for however weird I was, I very much wanted to be smart. I was very invested in this idea that even if I was kind of a black sheep around other people, I was going to be smart. And I wasn't going to drink. I wasn't going to do drugs. I was going to graduate first in my class. I was going to go to Yale. And I don't know. I had a lot of ideas about being important and trying to find my place in the world from a young age. But something happened. There was just something that happened to me one day after, all of these ideas about my, high morality and my high character. And I heard some kids talking about smoking pot, and I asked if I could join them. And I didn't like it a whole lot, but I started to do it every day. I should have known very quickly that there was something wrong. I really didn't like, I never liked the way that it made me feel, but what I did like was that immediately I felt like I was part of a group. I felt like I was part of a gang, and I felt like I fit. I just had to hide the fact that I didn't really like this stuff a whole lot. But something changed in me, and it was like nothing. You know, it was not premeditated. There was no conscious planning to, like, you know, become a member of, like, you know, the weird kids who smoke pot instead of just the weird kids who don't smoke pot. There was nothing that happened except one day my little ears just perked up, and I thought, well, maybe I'll try to belong there. Maybe here's where I'll fit in. And sometime after that, I thought, well, I mean, I'm smoking pot. I can probably try alcohol. You know, I'm probably kind of, you know, at that point. And I don't remember my first drink. And it weirded me out coming into AA that a lot of people seem to have these very profound first drink stories. And I have no idea what my first drink or my first drunk looked like. I don't know. I must have just been smoking too much pot, you know, to really remember all right, you know. But I, you know, I remember as it started, and I was like, man, this is where it's at. I didn't even know why I've been smoking all that weird green stuff. I didn't even know why people wanted to do anything else. If I felt like I had been a part of and good at something when I was smoking pot, I mean, when I drank, it was like I was cool to me, to you, to everybody else. I was friendly. I was bubbly. I could talk to you. I could look you in the eye. I felt like, you know, like I was good looking, like boys liked me, like I fit in. I was part of the crowd. And it was, I mean, it's like Bill Wilson said, I had arrived. Out of the war that was my life, I had arrived in the arms of alcohol. And, man, I just thought it was the darndest thing. And by this time, my family had noticed that I was sort of behaving strangely, you know, doing the weird things that we do in the beginning, just staying out too late, not really, you know, my eyes were red a lot, this, that, and the other thing. And I started to have these little consequences in my life that today, you know, are pretty alarming to me, but at that time it was like nothing, you know, getting in scream fights with my mom and dad, you know, them crying, them threatening to, you know, send me away, getting sent to all these counselors and psychologists and social workers and all this stuff because, you know, of my lack of desire to conform to what I thought was a stupid way that people were asked to live, which was without anything to make them feel better, without anything to make them feel different, and without any fun. I just thought that no one wanted me to have fun, and so it was just kind of whoosh. I had no conception that anyone was trying to protect me from real danger. I just thought no one wanted me to be happy, because that's the way that I saw the world from before I took a drink, but when I started to drink, it was just clarified and magnified 100-fold that it was everyone else's problem, and I was really just never the issue in my own mind, and you know, I didn't start drinking every day, more just because of lack of means than anything else, but my drinking took off, and I just thought it was the most fantastic thing. It set me free. I was so nervous, neurotic, afraid, and different all of the time. I never fit in until I drank, and I just felt like I had found the secret medicine that made everybody else able to act normal socially and not, like, have weird nervous breakdowns all the time and, you know, want to climb up to the top of the playground to make themselves hallucinate. I mean, it was like, it was revolutionary to me. And so I took off. And I don't want to talk too much about my drunkalog because some really amazing things have happened to me in sobriety. But at first it was all play. It was all fun. Every time I got drunk, it was an awesome time. There was no bad, and I couldn't imagine how it ever would be bad. When I look back on it now, you know, I can see that very, very quickly a lot of these kind of high morals that I had fell down in regards to my relationships with friends, my relationships with, you know, the young men that were in my periphery, with regards to the way that I treated my family, you know, with the priorities in my life. But it just felt so darn good that I just didn't concern me at all that I started to fail out of school and, you know, that I started to, like, become known as one of those girls and that, you know, my parents, my mom lost a lot of weight. I'll never forget when I kind of noticed that one day. I had, like, a little moment of clarity in my teens when things were kind of just still good and still party time. And I just looked at my mom one day, and I wasn't rattled by the fights. And, I was so used to the insanity, and I was so protected by this idea that it was everyone else's fault. It didn't really weigh on me. But I remember one day, and I looked at my mom, and she just looked thin. it ran away very quickly, this feeling that I had that maybe something was not quite right in my life. Maybe things were going in not such a great direction. But I didn't care. You know, I didn't care. And I didn't have the power to care. And I didn't know that then. I had no idea that that I lost the power of choice very quickly. But so it went. And I pretty much like dropped out of high school and, you know, finagled my way to college because this big idea I had about it's everyone else's fault and my family is the problem was this lie that I had not only fed myself, but anyone else who would listen, everyone at my school, all these professionals my parents took me to, and I fed it to them. And believing this, just like Bill talks about in his story, I commenced to forge the weapon that was soon going to shred me to ribbons. And I went off, you know, like pitchfork in hand, off to college, just so ready to take off in my life, you know, that once I got away from all these people that were trying to control me, right, that everything was going to be awesome. And I was going to be normal. I was going to do well in school, right? I wasn't going to drink to excess because although it didn't disturb me at the time, I was starting to drink more than maybe other ladies my age were doing. I had started to take on a quality of drinking that I would later recognize as compulsive drinking rather than just the acts of someone who likes to get drunk. But, you know, I plotted that I would not act in such a way. I was going to go to parties, and I was going to meet cute boys, and I was going to have lots of friends, and everyone was going to adore me because I would be free of the grip of this oppressive family that I had. It was like a drug to me, this idea, and I finally got there. I finally got to college, and it was not like that. It was not like that. I burned through how many colleges? Three colleges before I got sober, and every single time I had this idea, I'm wired to think that it's your fault. Left to my own devices, I blame the entire world for all of my problems, and I never, ever, ever point to my drinking. And if anyone else does, I mean, I quickly brush them off, divert their attention, tell some lie, you know? I mean, the type of lies that I told to divert from my drinking became less funny and more despicable. And my drinking took off. I mean, the quantities that I drank certainly, you know, became greater and all of that. And since I didn't have my family around to police me, I didn't have to worry about, you know, coming home and having to look sober late at night. You know, I was able to kind of be more of like an outward mess, and that was great. But my life without any sort of outside control to reel it in became a 24-hour-a-day drinking show. I mean, all I did, all I thought about was getting loaded. And when I woke up in the morning, I would think, you know, pretty much every day, well, I'll go to class tomorrow, but I'm just going to go get drunk and have fun today because, you know, I'm young and that's what young people do. Another lie that I fed myself, that this is what young people do. This is how you have a good time in college. This is the way you're supposed to live. I'll never get to be this age and this stage in my life again. I should really live it up. And the way that I lived it up, man, I mean, it was not the way other people lived it up. It did not look like other people's drinking. And like many of us do, I found everywhere I went a little cohort of people that drank kind of like I did. So I felt like I was normal. But the other kids were like going to class during the week. They would sleep in sometimes. And then on the weekends, they would, you know, go and go to a party and get really drunk and maybe do something stupid and kind of like laugh it off and go to school on Monday. And for me, I mean, like by the time I made it to the party, I was falling apart. You know, for me, a weekday was like spend the whole day trying to scrape up enough money to get a bottle of vodka, get my friend to drive me to the liquor store so I could buy the bottle of vodka with my fake ID, consume it as quickly as possible, drive really drunk around in her car, just, I mean, ready to mow someone down. It was terrifying the way that I drove when I drank. And then spend the rest of the night after the euphoria of that bottle wore off trying to figure out how I could kind of get something else. And then when I would come home or, you know, to my dorm or wherever I was, the rest of my night would be sort of consumed with, like, plotting out how the next day was going to be different. And, you know, I was going to go to class, and I was going to do my homework, and I was going to turn it all around, and it was going to be totally fine, and, you know, things would be cool. And I contented myself with that idea every night. I mean, I failed everything that semester. I passed one class, and I only had to go to that class, like, once a month. And even then, I didn't even get an A in it. You know, all you had to do was, like, go watch PowerPoints, and I couldn't do it. But each one of these places that I went, the way that I felt on the inside when I sobered up grew more and more malignant. My ability to exist sober for convenience or for requirement became practically non-existent. And that was a thing that I think I really started to notice in my life, that even if it were, like, important and to my benefit to be sober, to, you know, like, go to some event, I mean, you could have told me, like, you know, come here and we'll give you $100,000, just be sober on this day. And I could not reliably tell you that that was going to happen. It just called to me. Alcohol just called to me all the time. And I did start to dabble in some other substances, which I mentioned partially because the Big Book does mention them. You know, we do talk about the way that we try to manage our, and I tried to manage my drinking using other things to kind of prop it up and let me get through days without physically drinking alcohol and, you know, to sort of try to keep my life in order. And the effect is usually kind of the opposite, which is we're funny people. But after these couple colleges, the result was that I didn't just have any friends. I had long lists of people who I didn't want to see walking down the street on any given day. And my life began to be colored by a couple kinds of fear that had never really crept in before. Now, number one, I was afraid constantly that I was going to see someone to whom I owed money, I had embarrassed myself in front of, I had, you know, done something to hurt them, you know, whatever, who would, like, witness me, you know, in one of my rare forms when I would get completely plastered and, you know, run away with their boyfriend or, like, their money or, you know, like, start screaming at them in the middle of the road. I mean, you never knew what you were going to get out of me. I was, like, definitely one of those box of chocolates drunk. You never knew what you were going to get with me. And so, you know, this fear, it was very gradual. And I thought that it had more to do with my childhood and all the stuff that I felt like I had gone through and all these difficult circumstances in my life and that I had, like, anxiety, right? When in reality, you know, my fear was always that my drinking was going to catch up to me. It was always right behind me. And this other fear that I wasn't going to get enough alcohol and that I was going to run out. And that had, like, not really ever crept into my life. Like, I always felt pretty, like, gung-ho that I was going to have enough to drink. It always seemed to happen. But this deep feeling in the pit of my gut when I started to drink developed where, I mean, I would be, like, this far through a bottle, and I would already be wildly wondering in my head how I was going to get more, even though that bottle had seemed to look like enough when I started. And that hadn't happened before. And I didn't notice these things at the time. I think it's, you know, really only in sobriety that these things started to materialize. But so the way that I drink developed from that, and it started to revolve around avoiding people, places, and things that might, you know, give me that fear where I might feel caught. I was always ready to be caught in my own life because it was such a disaster because, you know, everything that I did was just, it just, a web of lies is how I hear people describe it, and I relate to that. Every move that I made was designed to either protect me from some consequences and or to get me closer to my next buzz. And I arrived at this final college. You know, I had moved around and chased some guys around because I really felt like they were going to fix me. And they didn't. They really didn't. And I, you know, every time I was convinced, like, I just need to go be with my soulmate. You know, you're like a teenager and you think you found your soulmate. I mean, like, we had plans, man. Like, we were going to meet this one guy. We're like, gonna, like, this sounds really awful, but, like, his dad was old and had a lot of money, and once his dad died, we were gonna, like, buy a boat and a lot of alcohol, and we were just gonna go live on this boat, and no one was ever gonna bother us, and we were gonna live this, like, amazing existence just out on the water, like, drinking. And those kinds of dreams, like, fueled me. They propelled me. They were the fabric, the tissue out of which my life was constructed. You know, these delusions, these fantasies, that I could not get out of bed without them. Because the truth about me is that, I mean, deep down inside, I'm just afraid and I can't live without a drink. I mean, I cannot handle the way that I feel as a human being without something in my system. And it's not my fault, you know. It's not like I decided to be that way. That's what alcoholism looks like on me. And I had no idea. And I didn't know that that feeling was alcoholism when I got there. I was, like, really confused about how that could have anything to do with alcohol because I didn't connect the way that I drank to the way that I feel. I just did it. I just had to do it. It was just always on my mind, and it was, like, my whole being and all of my actions just naturally, like, that was where my compass pointed north. And I thought that that was how a lot of people lived. I mean, I knew that my life sort of seemed extra messy because of my family and all these bad things that have happened. But I didn't feel like I was that abnormal in terms of my relationship with alcohol. And I arrived at this last college, and I had been to a rehab. My mom, my poor sweet mother, God bless her, she walked in on me shooting heroin and was really concerned about that, understandably so, you know. So, and I'll never forget this day, not because of this deep damage I inflicted on my mother, but because I knew with every fiber of my being that if I could offer to go to rehab first and they didn't have to force me, my family, that I could continue to manipulate them and that I could again turn the situation to my favor because, like I said, I mean, you know, my compass points north towards setting me up to be able to get loaded without anyone messing with me. And so I went, and it was an AA rehab, like, oh God, and it was just horrible. I hated it. And I managed to get loaded in there, and I met a bunch of other people who didn't give a darn about being sober and who were trying to game the system too. And this further reinforced this belief that I had that this sobriety thing was crap. And it was like a product of people trying to make us live in a different way than we wanted to live because it's my life. You know, I didn't ask to be born. And if you felt the way that I felt, you would live the way that I live too. I mean, I had such a mountaintop that I stood on. And so I'm coming out of rehab, and despite the fact that I thought it was really stupid, and I talked my way out of it like a week early. I mean, it was just a mess, but having to be physically sober for those 21 days, well, minus the times I got loaded, not 21 continuous days like we do in here. But it did something to me, you know, and I started to think about the way my life was because, you know, eventually, I mean, I was just kind of getting loaded around the clock and I didn't even know what I felt like anymore because I was just pumped full of, you know, whatever you put in my hand. And I started to just reflect on, like, you know, my life was, on the outside, sure, it was a mess. I mean, I was, you know, failing out of schools and my parents were concerned and this and that. But taking a small step back, I started to see that there were these deep touches of darkness on my life. You know, that I experienced very little happiness, not even a lot of euphoria. You know, my insides felt empty and I didn't really know who I was anymore. And I didn't want to stop drinking. Right? Like I didn't still think that that was a problem, but I thought, well, you know, you should probably back off and we should try this again and try to live differently again and, you know, give it another go where we're going to be a hardworking, a productive member of society. And I had never been able to do that. Right. I mean, I just wasn't one of those drunks that could do that. I just instantly fell apart. But coming out of this rehab and going off to this new school, I made lots of sweet promises to myself about how I was and wasn't going to live. I wasn't going to do those other drugs anymore. I was only going to drink on the weekends. I was going to be a good girl, and we were going to have a new life, and things were going to be okay. Of course, I didn't tell anyone else this, because you talk to me about my drinking, and now comes the pitchfork, because, you know, can't no one tell me anything. But I got there, and, I mean, within about 2 weeks, everyone knew me as this drunk girl, this drunk promiscuous girl who lived on the second floor of J Building who smoked Newports. Within 2 weeks of me being at this place, so many sweet promises. Shortly after that, like, I found, a drug-addicted hobo on the side of the road and brought him back to my dorm to live with me. And, I mean, I moved fast. And, you know, like, and it's funny now, but at the time, I wasn't even baffled. It just felt normal, you know? Again, that compass, my whole being, just, it was like it just happened. I didn't even know how it happened, but it just happened. And it was then that I really started to feel like my life was really out of control. I mean, it had looked out of control to you for years, for like a really long time. I mean, I had been to my first 12-step meeting when I was, like, 15. I think because, like, my friend's mom was, like, making him go. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll go with you. And sometimes, like, I could only see my boyfriend at those meetings because he, you know, his mom would only let him out of the house for meetings. Things like that. I mean, there was so much evidence splattered across my life that things were not okay and that I was a mess and that I had no control. But after those few weeks, after turning over this new leaf, I mean, things changed and the quality of my drinking changed again. And, you know, I had been sort of walking this edge of fear and living in this sort of vague darkness and emptiness for some time. I mean, it was like the trap doors to hell of my life just opened. And for those last few years, there was no joy or happiness or excitement or camaraderie, friendship, goodness, in my life. I just didn't care about anything else. And something in me had sort of started to snap. And I started drinking like it talks about in the Big Book, where, you know, I was just like a denizen of King Alcohol, right? And it's so hard to find the words to describe what it feels like to be there, but I know you know, or you wouldn't be wasting your time on a Sunday night sitting here being with me. And it went on like that. And I actively started to not want to drink anymore. And it was a big thing that had happened, you know. I had never not wanted to drink. I mean, I'd always wanted my life circumstances to get better, but I had never wanted to, like, actually stop drinking, you know. And I started to try different methods with which to control myself and my drinking, and they failed. I started actively trying to use the services of these nice professionals that people have been trying to put in my life. I tried psychiatric medications to try to manage myself. I tried meditation, you know. I tried, like, I went to this one therapist who hooked me up to this little machine, and, like, you would hold these little, like, vibrating pods in your hand, and it was hooked up to this other thing, and, like, I would hold onto them and, like, squeeze them, and then we did this, like, tapping thing, and it was supposed to, like, realign my, like, chi, and so I wouldn't have to feel like that anymore. I mean, it was crazy. I was just searching for the sound. I was looking for something to help me, and I didn't want to stop. I mean, I didn't want to live the rest of my life without alcohol, but drinking had taken over my heart and my mind and my soul. And I mean, I was just so lost. But the way that I felt sober overwhelmed it every time. I mean, every single time that I was sober for more than a day, I mean, I felt like I was going to rip my skin off. I could not bear it. There was nothing about me that could handle being sober. Forced sobriety would happen. I would make it like a week or two, you know, propped up on some medication or weird tapping thing or sweet promise or whatever. And every single time, I mean, it got darker and darker and darker. And at the end of the road, I felt like a sick dog you see on a farm that crawls under the porch and waits to die. And all the lights were off in my life. And the only people that I saw, you know, on a weekly and monthly basis were people from whom, you know, I got drugs, or a scattering of people who lived the way that I lived and would sort of come and go out of this dark apartment that I lived in, and shared my goal, which was, you know, just oblivion all the time. And I didn't know what to do. I wrote out this, like, list of times of meetings. I was, like, really high or drunk one day, and I got these, like, pens and these highlighters, and I made this beautiful, I wish I still had it, this beautiful list of meetings in my area, and the dates and times, whether they're women's meetings or Big Book meetings, and I taped it on the inside of my front door, and I looked at it every day, and I thought every day I should go to a meeting. Every day I wanted it to be different. I would go to bed at night, and I would make these lists, you know. I would, like, I would do a bunch of stuff that makes you real energetic, and I would make these crazy detailed lists of what I was going to do tomorrow to change my life, how it was going to be different, you know, how I was going to be okay, how we were going to turn back the tide, not drink. I mean, I was unable to function at any level. And I would make these lists, and I would have to, again, you know, like I had done in the past, I would have to comfort myself with this idea that things were going to change, or I couldn't fall asleep because the demons would scream, you know. And alcohol stopped working. It stopped working to quiet my head. I would drink and drink and drink, and I could not get drunk enough. I could not get loaded enough. I mean, I would, in any manner you can imagine, and I mean any, I would apply substances to my body and to my psyche and drink alcohol until my wallet ran out and the bottle ran out, and I could not get loaded enough to shut my head up. And it was like Groundhog Day. Every single day was exactly the same. And I didn't know. I didn't know what to do. And I had a really amazing experience. This isn't everyone's experience, but this is how it was for me. This is the what happened. And what I was like, because I just told you a lot about what things were like, but what I was like, I was terrified. I was in despair. I was incredibly dishonest. I stole everything that wasn't nailed down. I lied, you know, for sport and to keep myself, to keep that web of lies, that dishonesty out of which my life was constructed together so it wouldn't all come crumbling down. I was incredibly selfish and I did not care how my actions affected the lives and hearts of other people. And I was empty. I was completely bankrupt on my insides. And I was on my bed one night, and I had been drinking, and I couldn't get drunk enough. And it was just another one of those nights where I just couldn't get drunk enough. I could not. I was drinking like 94 proof rum, like furiously, and I just couldn't do it. And I'd taken all these pills and shot all these drugs, and I could not get loaded enough to escape my head. And I felt like I was just gonna expire at that moment. I didn't know what to do, and I knew there was this part of me that just knew that I was screwed, and that and I was 20 years old. And I knew that I was going to die. And I had known. I had been in a lot of ambulances and hospitals. You know, I had a lot of people that told me I was going to die. But I knew that I was going to die. And there was nothing that I could do about it. And I don't know if I said a little foxhole prayer, but my heart did. And something happened to me. I was just laying on this stupid bed that was all covered in pee and blood and puke and, you know, beer cans and all kinds of nasty stuff, and there were maggots in the sink, and there was blood all over my walls and my floors, and in that hellhole, I mean, just something happened, and I have never been the same, you know. All those years of stumbling in and out of meetings, all those times that people had told me that things could be different, and I just told them, just get the heck away from me. They all just made sense, and there's just like this little voice inside of me that says, you know, you don't have to drink anymore. You don't have to do it. You need to go back to AA, and they're going to help you, and you don't have to drink anymore. And to me, it came suddenly, you know, that that moment in my life that that things have never been the same since. And I did. I went to this women's meeting. It was a Sunday, and I just cried and cried and cried. I just cried like a child and barely let the meeting go on because I was yelping so loud with my self-pity and my brokenness and my fear. And, you know, these women, they gave me this little 24-hour chip, and they just patted me on the back, and they just, you know, they just told me to stay. And I did, and that's where things started for me. And they didn't tell me it was going to be all right, because it wasn't going to be all right. If you're like me, it is not going to be okay unless I do something about it. And I'm glad no one gave me that impression, you know. I mean, I picked it up anyway, you know, despite this deep desire that was truly a gift from something that I didn't understand to stay sober. You know, a lot of the propositions of AA seemed like really big and scary to me. Like the fourth step and the fifth step were like immediately glaring problems to me, and sponsorship and honesty, because at this point in my life, you know, I was riddled with so much dishonesty, and most of it didn't really have to do with like breaking the law or anything like that. It was just the way that I lived. I mean, my disease runs really deep. I am a real McCoy alcoholic. I'm going to die, you know, without y'all. And the way that I know that is I came into AA, I have this deep desire, and all I can do is lie to all y'all. I mean, from the moment I opened my mouth, the only really honest thing that I said was I want help and I want to be sober, but I fed y'all crazy tall tales and all kinds of weird stuff for months. I mean, I was shady. I was still stealing. I was like sort of, you know, manipulating around like little groups of friends and stuff to try to get liked. I mean, immediately, like, this resounding desire to get sober was still living in competition with my compulsion to lie and steal and manipulate you and not tell you the truth, because I really don't want you to tell me how to live. I really don't want you to tell me to change, because I'm so ashamed of my self-centeredness, and I know, whoo, I know it when I go to bed and when I wake up, especially with no alcohol. I mean, oh my God, it colors my entire world, but I'm so ashamed, and I can't tell you because I don't think you're like that. I don't think that when you're sober, you live the way that I live. And I continued on like that for about a year, and I switched sponsors. Like, I would get a sponsor, and we would, like, work the first few steps, and I would, like, not really be honest about anything, about the way that I was living, and then I would switch, and I would blame it on them and how they sucked for some reason. Like, I don't know. I just came up with these cockamamie excuses for, like, how these women with, like, all the sober time who were trying to help me just, like, didn't understand me, and they didn't love me and whatever. And I would switch because I was really trying to avoid, I was really trying to avoid this dishonesty thing, and I knew I couldn't hold back the tide forever, but the way that I felt, and I felt this in sobriety, was like, I'll get honest when, you know, I'm going to clean it all up, and then I'll get honest after that. And meanwhile, you know, sober, my life was falling apart. I mean, it couldn't externally get a whole lot worse because it was bad. But internally, I mean, I started to slowly go insane in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a ton of meetings, tons of meetings. I did a lot of good service work. I picked up a lot of cigarette butts. I put a lot of newcomers in my car. I went out to Denny's a lot. I went to the dances, you know. I ate so many mozzarella sticks and had so many deep conversations about AA, during which, instead of talking about my own experience, I would pull whatever parroted nonsense that I had memorized at the last meeting and whatever crazy interpretation I had of the big book that sounded good to me. And I was, like, trying to walk and talk like a duck. But I wasn't a duck. I wasn't no duck. I was not an actively participating member in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you could... I actually almost forgot this until now. I told people that I made up a sponsor that I had. Oh, my gosh. She was a lady, like a real lady that I had met years ago in meetings when I was younger, and her name was Lisa, and she was just an awesome lady, but people would prompt me about, you know, who's your sponsor. I would say, oh, you don't know her, you know, she lives across the country, and I would make up stuff that she said to justify my actions. I mean, I was nuts, y'all. I got here, and not only was I, like, you know, I didn't smell great. My hair was a mess. I didn't know how to dress myself or cook or clean, you know, any of that stuff. I was just living like an animal. But I, like, was so wrapped up in the shame and pride that I had about really asking you for help that, like, again, in Alcoholics Anonymous, my life was colored by the fear that I was going to be found out and completely ruled by my lies, right? And for an alcoholic like me, and this is where I found out that I was a real alcoholic, right? Like, I could see that these two sort of criteria that were presented to me for being an alcoholic, which is when I drink, I can't always stop. You know, I have two drinks and I'm really thirsty and I can't seem to drink enough. I could definitely relate to that. And that when I try to stop, I can't stop entirely. You know, that list of meetings on my door, I mean, those were cool. But what I didn't connect yet was that I needed to have something to replace the drink. I needed to change. Something inside of me needed to shift at a level that I could not create on my own. And during this time, switching sponsors, not really doing any steps, you know, like being dishonest, I legitimately started to lose my mind. I couldn't sleep. I would do all kinds of weird stuff to try to sleep at night. I was stealing just like a crazy person to try to make me feel full. I mean, I got arrested. Like, stealing, and the guy, like, the cop was asking me, and I'm like, I don't even know why I did it. I'm like, I'm crazy. That's all I could say to him. I'm crazy. I'm sober, and I'm crazy. And he was like, okay, lady. He, like, let me go. I think he was scared to be alone with me. But I moved. I was living in Washington State at the time, and I moved to D.C. to live with my parents since I had finally revealed to them, you know, that I was sober, and the things had kind of hit the fan, and they were like, you should really come live with us and just kind of chill for a while. And I said, okay. And I moved to D.C. And, again, I thought, fresh start. I won't have to be crazy. And I did the same thing, right? I wandered around meetings and painted faces of myself to people who I didn't even know or have a reason to do so. This culminated in me deciding I needed to be institutionalized because I felt my head just screamed all the time. I felt... so anxious and depressed. And by this time, I knew that I did not have anxiety or depression. I knew that the way that I lived and the way that I felt without alcohol was both very anxiety-inducing and depressing. And that I couldn't seem to change. I was, like, praying like crazy. I've been doing, like, these meditation tapes. Like, I'm calling all these people who have a lot of time and trying to, like, whatever, like, get some of their sobriety by osmosis. And I just can't do it because I just – I'm not ready. And I tried to check myself into these institutions. And I actually got accepted at one. I did. They said, we'll take you. You have health insurance. We will take you. We don't know if we can help you. Because they would ask me, like, what's wrong with you? Like, did you relapse? I'm like, no, but – I'm crazy, and I just need you to, like, check me in. I need someone to, fix me. I just didn't even know. And right after I got accepted, I met the woman who sponsors me today. And it was just another one. This is another pivotal point. This is the second part that my life has never been the same. I went to this meeting, and I actually called the hotline in D.C., the WAA hotline, and I asked this lady, like, I'm like, can you please recommend me some meetings? Like, I'm young, and I really need people who are really serious. Like, I really need help. And she referred me to two meetings, and they were, like, I think they were on the same day, and the one was at 6:30. I went to the one at 6:30, and I shared, and nothing connected. And then this other one was 8:30, and I was laying on my bed, and I was just crushed by the depression of being me. And you may know that feeling if you have, you know, the sort of alcoholism that I have, where just, like, it's so heavy to just be alive. And I said, you know, another little prayer, like, please, God, get me out of bed. And I did, and I got to this meeting, and I was late, and a woman in the back, her name's Tracy Canada, she's actually still sober today. She's a lovely human being, and she gave me her chair. And she couldn't have known. She didn't know. She didn't know nothing. This meeting was overcrowded. Everyone's standing up, and she gave me her chair. I'm sure she wanted to sit down. No one wants to stand up and, you know, march. It's cold and all that. But she gave me her chair. And the whole meeting, all I heard was this lady all the way at the front. And she just shared and said whatever thing. But she said a thing that I'll never forget and that changed my life forever. And she just said, if you can't get out of bed in the morning, come talk to me. And I had never heard that. I've never heard her say it again. And I found her, and I didn't even introduce myself. I was like, I need you to be my sponsor. Like, you need to help me, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't a really, like, polite request. I just, like, beelined up to her. And, you know, God bless her. She took me home to her house that night and started reading the book with me. And she had a job. She was in school. She had a bunch of other women she sponsored. She had a boyfriend. I mean, she had stuff going on in her life. She, you know, it wasn't like she had some, like, excess of free time floating around. But she knew, just the way that we know each other, the way that we can sense when one of us is dying. Because I was dying again. Stone cold sober, I was dying of alcoholism. And she could see it. And I was so lucky that this God of my misunderstanding led me to somebody who understood the gravity of alcoholism as it presents in an alcoholic like me. Which is that I need help, I need something to change me, or I am going to die, like, you know, before too long. Like, I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to be around here because I'm going to drink or kill myself because I can't stand it for much longer. And she took me through the book. We did not waste a minute. I mean, she sat me down in her house that night. We read the doctor's opinion in the foreword. She gave me an assignment. And you know, we went page by page, and when we didn't know a word, we looked it up. When I didn't know what something meant, I asked. She would ask me questions. When the book talked about writing something, we wrote it. When the book talked about praying something, we prayed it. And there we were. And there I was at that four step. And, you know, thank God for desperation. Thank God for the gift of desperation in my life, because by the time we got to that four step, I was ready to go. And I had spent, like, all this time and all this trouble trying to avoid that. But I knew, you know, I knew that I was dying, and I knew there was something in me that just knew that this was the only way out, the only way out. And I did it, and it was like a Bible. I mean, this thing, I had like 500 names on it. I resented everybody who I had ever met. Oh, yeah, Joyce calls it my masterpiece, my great American novel. Oh, my God, that poor lady. She listened to every drop of it, too, and it was just inane crap, most of it. Like, I didn't know that I was that resentful, but everyone in the world, I was just polarized against you. I believed that you were judging me, that I was better than you, that I was worse than you. I mean, like, I had no ability to form a true partnership with anybody. And she explained to me that what we were going to do was that we were going to take out the trash. And when she put it to me that way, I became less afraid to read it, because I was scared. I mean, I wrote the thing because I heard people say, you know, write a four-step as though there is no fifth. And I took that to heart, and I believe that's the best way to write an inventory, is write it like you're going to take that to your grave. Because that's the only way I can be honest, you know, when faced with my own mortality is the only time that an alcoholic like me is able to gut themselves. And I did. And I was so afraid. And it's so funny because, like, I have this sponsor. She sponsored a lot of people. She's heard all kinds of crazy stuff on four steps. Like, mine was, like, you know, there were no, like, bank robberies or whatever. And it was just, I was just petty, self-centered, dishonest, and afraid. That was it. A manipulative, self-seeking, garden variety alcoholic with nothing to offer the world but fear, anger, resentment, manipulation, right? And she had, you know, she had heard it all. But I was afraid. And I finally spit out the last of it, and she fed me some pieces of truth about myself that no one in my life had ever dared to tell me. No one in my life had ever sat me down and took me apart the way she did that night. And she did it with love. I wasn't angry. I could feel that there was something there that was bigger and different than all the other people that had tried to take me apart. And she explained to me that I was a self-centered alcoholic who, if I didn't have some sort of spiritual awakening, if I didn't change at the core of my being, that I was going to die. I know I'm talking a lot. I'm going to die. There's a lady named Valerie Downing in Richmond who always talks about her old sponsor, who said, "You're a mad dog alcoholic and y'all going to die," if you've ever heard her talk. And that's like that was how it felt. But it rang very true in my heart, and it does today, because that is the truth. This is not some, like, cute little game that I get to play in my life. I mean, this is for realsies, you know? And she fed me those things, and she asked me if I wanted to be different, and I told her I did. And she said, okay. And I went home, and I read that to the God that I sort of had that I didn't really understand. And I cracked, you know? I looked at who I was, and with my best thinking, with all the love of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the support that had been given me, the floors I had mopped, the cigarette butts that I had picked up, the trips to Denny's, the newcomers in my car, that with all of that, this is me, and this is how I live, and I can't help it. I can't stop it. And I finally became willing to change. I finally became willing to ask for help to stop lying and stop stealing and stop manipulating and stop treating everyone in my life like crap. Because I did, man. I mean, I did. I put a pretty face on it. I painted the trash can lots of nice colors, but I still just did not treat people with the kind of genuine love and giving that people showed me. And that was a hard pill to swallow, but swallow what we did. And we went and we went ahead and did those amends. I mean, you know, we wrote that A-step list, and she put me in the car and said, go, you know, go forth. And I'm like, this is kind of fast. There's no need to wait. Like, I don't need to, like, become entirely willing. She's like, well, you're entirely willing now, so go, you know? Because she knew, you know? She knew that I didn't have time. And I've sponsored women like that who don't have the time to waste, where it's happening right now, it's going down. And that's, man, every day I thank God she saw that in me. And she didn't give in to any of my fearful nonsense. And so I was able to start making my amends, and something happened to me. Something happened. I don't know where it was. I don't think I can, like, confine it to one step or anything like that. But dismantling this idea that I can manage my life, that, like, I know what's best, that I can, you know, successfully navigate relationships with love and compassion, and seeing that I don't just need you know, help in the form of, like, nice phone calls and things like that, but that I need something bigger than me. I mean, that was really humbling for me to accept, because I was, like, thought I was an atheist when I got here. And seeing the things that happened as I tried to change my behavior and relationships, they just changed me, and I started to feel a degree of peace that I had only ever associated with being at that perfect level of drunk and high and God knows what else, that thing I chased for years, just perfect, you know, just okay. And I couldn't remember a time in my life where I'd ever felt like that without drugs and alcohol. And it kind of crept up gradually, and one day I just woke up and I was comfortable being who I was. I had always hated myself and you, and suddenly, you know, or gradually or whatever, I was okay. And sobriety has been crazy. I mean, that's just the start of it, you know what I mean? All y'all know, we could talk for hours about what sobriety has brought into my life, and I can definitely tell you about, like, good material things, like some cool material stuff has happened, but and I haven't always been able to see this, but, you know, the central fact in my life developed to be that I could be part of this fellowship of the Spirit, and that I could have these real connections with other human beings, both you and the members of my family, and that I didn't have to be this, like, stone-cold block of ice anymore. I didn't have to be this person that was always searching, always looking, always trying to move on to the next thing, always ready for something else to fix me and change me, that I could just be whoever God made me be. Which, God, I hated people who talk like that. When I hear stuff come out of my mouth, I'm like, I can't believe I'm that guy now. Like, it's crazy. But I became able to help other women, and I started to sponsor people. And, man, like, I didn't know, and I still don't know. I'll say that in another few years. Like, I didn't know. The level to which that has changed me as a human being has been incredibly profound. And perhaps the most important thing that's happened to me since I got sober, because I got experience with getting better. The girl who no one thought could get better. Even when I came in here, people thought I would drink, you know what I mean? I just looked that kind of way. It's crazy. Every professional had told me that I was hopeless. Everyone in my life had written me off, and I was better. I was walking up straight, looking people in the eye, and even though my life was still crazy, even though there was still a lot going on, like, I've had a lot of damage and I'm still cleaning it up, but the quality of my relation to the world changed dramatically, and that enabled me to try to help other women. And through everything that's happened in the last year, you know, I have like 3 minutes left. In the last year of my life, it's been a crazy year. I moved, I got engaged, I made a lot of decisions that may or may not be in God's ultimate plan for me. I started to get a certain idea of what my sober life was going to be like on the outside, and how things were going to look, and how my sort of happily ever after I've done all this work in AA was going to work out. And things have kind of crumbled to the ground, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, my life has completely leveled itself again, more or less. And through all this, and I didn't think that was supposed to happen when you were sober, like, at all. Like, I pictured suffering and struggle and sobriety as this very, like, graceful, victorious thing that was going to give me, like, a lot of eloquent words and all that. And my experience has just been that, like, I'm still a person. I'm still going to have stuff happen to me. My life is still not going to be some sort of crazy, self-satisfying fairy tale. But, you know, what I have experienced is that, like, you have given me the opportunity to live a normal human life. You know, my problems in my life today are just like the problems of Joe Blow down the street who's not an alcoholic. I never had the opportunity for problems other than, like, where am I going to get my next drink? Like, who did I hurt last night with my poor behavior? You know, what did I fracture today in my relationships? And that has been incredible, because when things go bad, when things go wrong, I don't have to hide under the covers. You've given me the ability to walk through my life, you know, get up in the morning when I've made mistakes, when I've been wrong, when other things have been wrong, when things have gone completely haywire. And you've given me the ability to get out of bed and face it, you know, and to try to do my best. And I just never had that. I never had that. And no matter what's going on with my life, if I help another alcoholic, I'm okay. That no matter what, you know, the women that I sponsor have been, oh my God, just like, have carried me, you know, have given me purpose and direction when I felt like everything was falling apart and like I just couldn't go on. And the last thing I think I'll say is just that for all the things in my life, all the goals that I've had and the things I've wanted to accomplish, which are, you know, they're fine, when I have remembered that this universe, this God, or whatever you want to call it, has made me me so I can help other alcoholics. I feel okay, that is what I'm here for. And whenever I'm curious or confused or doubtful about why I'm alive, why I breathe, is to help the next drunk. And when I keep that in mind, my life is so rich and full, and I am so grateful for y'all. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope, you know, I hope we can keep Alcoholics Anonymous as alive and vibrant and well as it is today for many, many years to come so that more people get to experience this. And I really thank you for having me at your group. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for letting me share.